serving a village population is, this guy is working in the field the day he gets sick. And he thinks the timing is right. So timing is right means he does not have a commitment in the field. There's no crop coming in, or there's an irrigation day that he needs to tilt his land. On that particular day, he decides to go to the city center and gets a treatment for his wife or kid, whatever. And they want to come in. So it's a walk-in. Walk-in means they don't have an appointment. They want to come in early in the day, get all their tests done, get the test reports done by afternoon, show you again in the afternoon, get the medicine and go back home before sunset. So that system works not only pretty tight, you have to complete that whole cycle of first visitation and medicine by afternoon.
Welcome to today's episode. We're excited to introduce Dr. Vikram Jain, an orthopedic surgeon with an extraordinary story. Dr. Jain built a hospital from scratch in rural India, transforming a modest facility into a 500-bed institution that now serves thousands across three states. His hospital is not only a healthcare model, but also a training center for medical professionals. And Dr. Jain's journey is marked by courage, perseverance, and a passion for bringing quality care to underserved communities. Starting with personal savings and loans, he implemented patient-focused systems tailored to rural lifestyles. His creativity and adaptability shine as he meets the unique needs of his villagers, many traveling long distances for same-day diagnosis and expecting same-day treatment. By embracing digital technology, he enhanced patient care and operational efficiency. Kind of what sets Dr. Jain apart is his curiosity and willingness to look beyond his field for inspiration, a hallmark of successful innovators. What's interesting about this story also is how you leverage India's evolving health insurance policies and government mandates to make care accessible to thousands previously unable to afford it. It is an interesting insight into the impact of well-designed government programs can have, even in resource-poor environments. Join us as we dive into Dr. Jain's inspiring journey and learn how one doctor's vision and determination reshaped healthcare for an entire community. Actually, I should be more accurate. It should be two doctors, because although this is going to be largely about Dr. Jain, Vikram, it is also about his wife, whom we didn't have a chance to interview, but she was a huge and important part of this process.
So, Dr. Vikram Jain, I'm an orthopedic surgeon, mostly doing joint replacement surgery, hips and knees. Started out as a sports medicine guy, was doing a lot of ACLs, BCLs, but then career branched out to joint replacement, robotics, and a lot of personalized arthroplasty, kinematics. But at a time, 10 years ago, I was working in a system which was, we call this, owned by a corporate conglomerate. They were the steel guys. I live in a city, it's called the Steel City for India, so a lot of steel factories. So they had a hospital they were running as a philanthropic effort. So I was working there, and I was kind of feeling they had their own vision of how the hospital needs to grow. And I was growing in terms of my own surgical practice and technology, and they were probably not ready to invest as aggressively I wanted them, which led to the thought that, is there a possibility that we can run our own system? Which at the time in my city and the rest of the country was single doctor or couple doctor owned practices. So this is very common in India. So you're a physician, or you married a gynecologist, and you two of you run a system. It's a small house and, you know, small clinic, and that's just about it. But the big hospitals are either government owned, which we know from experience that we're not serving the population very well, or corporates were coming in with big money people running the show through MBAs and stuff. So we decided that we thought that can we make our own hospital in a faraway place away from the metro. So we call them a tier three cities. So metro, Delhi and Bombay would be tier one. So we're not even tier two, we're tier three cities. Small population, largely serving villagers as our primary clientages. And my city is right at the edge of three states. So I was taking in patients from Rajasthan, Punjab and Haryana, right at the edge. It's called Hisar in a state called Haryana. It's about 3 hours west of Delhi. So that idea was baking, can we start it? And I was telling it to one of my friends and he said, go ahead and I'll support you and stuff like that. Took me 2 years to bake it. Finally bought a piece of land, and which was away from the city center, and started constructing it and not knowing anything about it. So I was talking to architects, not knowing anything about it. I was talking to the contractors and still running my own practices. Build a hospital. At the time, we were smaller. We were about 100 bedded. We started with long journey. We call this as a greenfield project. So bought a piece of land, agricultural land. So you get permissions from the government to convert it into a commercial project. So I was working as the doctor and I was working as the medical director, also the superintendent, as the HR guy. I all roles combined into one. And obviously the struggles of a new system. And obviously my money had ran out. My loan had ran out. My personal money had run. I had put everything that I ever owned and my wife's jewelry and stuff into it. And everything. And it's a big risk that we took. And like any project, the first couple of years were very struggling and patients wouldn't come. And there was a distance from the city center to coming to the place we were working. And then gradually it picked it up. And then our practices started growing within that system to a point that 4 years passed and we were doing pretty well to the point that people started saying we need to construct again because we were not able to accommodate patients that were coming in. In India, a lot of these patients are walk-ins, which is different from any Western system where you take an appointment and come. Serving a village population is, this guy is working in the field the day he gets sick and he thinks the timing is right. The timing is right means he does not have a commitment in the field. There's no crop coming in or there's an irrigation day that he needs to tilt his land. On that particular day, he decides to go to the city center and gets a treatment for his wife or kid, whatever. And they want to come in, so it's a walk-in. Walk-in means they don't have an appointment. They want to come in early in the day, get all their tests done, get the test reports done by afternoon, show you again in the afternoon, get the medicine and go back home before sunset. So that system works not only pretty tight, you have to complete that whole cycle of first visitation and medicine by afternoon. Not really. That's what they like, but that's not happened. So a lot of personal modifications a doctor would do in the sense that, so you clinically think that he has this problem, but his MRI is still not available, right? So you would still start the treatment and asking them, you probably take it for a week and just go to the physio and stuff like that. And then we'll have the report next time you come in and stuff like that.
A common theme of successful startups is their ability to identify and meet a pain point as opposed to a problem. A problem is something you can deal with at a later time. A pain point requires your immediate attention. And if a business can help someone address a pain point, they have a customer. In this community, the pain point is the length of time required to receive standard care, and it does not match the rhythms of an agrarian community. The genius I think Vikram showed was not that he identified the problem. This was, after all, his community. He understood their challenges. The genius was in challenging the idea that this rhythm could not be met with more efficient care protocols. He had the curiosity to ask the question, can we do better? Can we meet people where they are? Can we deliver the care they're requesting, even if it isn't standard of care? And what would it take to deliver it? He then executed a solution. Brilliant. The results are stunning. Let's hear more.
When we started, almost everybody coming in from the villagers didn't have no insurance or third party. Third party is the term that we use in the country. So somebody else is paying for your medical treatment. So either it's an insurance or a government. On paper, the medical treatment for an Indian is free as provided by the government, which means he can go to a government-funded hospital and get treatment. But the problem is that these hospitals have not kept pace with the population and the technology. And they're understaffed, and most people do not actually prefer going there because of the obvious reasons, which means they end up coming to private practices. Like when we start, we got popular and sent to a point that we needed to expand from 100 bed. Now we are 500 bedded system with teaching programs and, you know, transplant things and nursing colleges. And we do a lot of stuff now, but the story is not this. The story is in the 8 years of journey, the government in India realized that medicine or healthcare needs to shift from what it was there 10, 15 years ago. The GDP spending in our India country was abysmal on healthcare. And everybody was saying that it needs to go up to 2, 3% of GDP for if you were to provide healthcare to 1.5 billion people, 1.4 billion people. Was that government needs to, number one, increase the number of doctors that are coming out. So make more medical colleges, number one. Number two, spend a lot into infrastructure, make more hospitals, government funded. Now, two basic problems with this. Increasing the number of medical colleges and increasing the number of government owned hospital, if you start today, is a 10-year journey. Because a 5-year med school 8 to 10 years of becoming a specialist, and you don't have seats, first you have to build the infrastructure. So many years will pass. So everybody knew, even if the government had the will, had the money to do it, we're looking at 20, 25 years of lag time before the country would have enough doctors and infrastructure to treat everybody. And the whole task was so daunting that nobody was actually ready to take the right step. Now, in the 8 years of the journey, the government realized this. I think somebody must have this brilliant idea. I call this brilliant. He said, can we think out of the box of treating this problem? So he said, let's do this. So the couple of steps the government did. One, they asked the basic question. Why there are so many few doctors in this country? So he said, we run a system that was imported from the Britishers when we were under colonial rule, which said that a professor in a medical college can train one postgraduate every year. That was the basic premise. So if you're a professor in a medical college, you can train an orthopedic surgeon a year, which means 3 years, three orthopedic surgeons. So government said, why this 1:1 ratio? How do we come with this? There's a system way back. Nobody really thought about it. So government changed that ratio from 1:2 to 1:3 now. So each professor can train three, which means in a single stroke, they increase the output of specialists in this country by thrice, number one. Second thing they asked was, in the country, only government hospital can train or produce a specialist doctor. But some very good private hospitals still exist and they're doing excellent work. So government asked, can we ask these guys to train specialists out of the government-owned system? Somebody said, yes, we can. If we do due diligence and if we make the infrastructure, if we have libraries and access to journal and all the infrastructure a hospital needs to train a fellow or whatever. So they started this program, which was a big hit in the 8 year period. From me, who is a private system, now I train residents in orthopedics. Now I train fellows in joint replacement surgery, to my guy who does training in surgery, gynecology, radiology, anesthesia. So suddenly the number of doctors in the country quadrupled coming out in a short span of 5 years. So nobody really realized the amount, magnitude of change that the government actually did. Now there are people who will say this is not working well, because when you suddenly increase the output, people obviously worry about the quality of the output. Some of these systems may be producing doctors that are not fully trained or not gone through the whole shebang. But I firmly believe that this is for a country of our size and for the villagers and depth of the country where you need to take healthcare, this was an excellent move. So number one, this is one big change the government did. The second they realized, can I make a new hospital in every district, 1,000-bedded hospital, and then spread the healthcare? The government said, no, possibly not, because it's such a daunting task. In a reversal, the government did. Government issued a healthcare card to 1/3 of the population of the country, which they ensured is valid in a private system too. So earlier, healthcare was free of cost to any Indian, but it was not being used because of the poor services that had been provided to get giving this guy a health card, which covers most basic problems that the country faces. So they made a list. So these are the common orthopedic problems, and they put joint replacement in it. These are common surgical problems. These are common gynecological problems. And all these, they issued one card to each family. And they made sure that this is the amount the government will honor if you go to a private system and want to get treated. So in a matter of a year, my input from, let's say, in a month, we were taking in 5,000 patients, reached 25,000 patients, because everybody now had a health card. And these guys could never access my system, well, not my system, but system that were private and a little daunting in terms of money, because they never had insurance. So these guys walking into my clinic, carrying those cards, these are villages. Earlier, they would pay out of pocket. And this was a discussion that you used to have every other day. I would tell them, your wife needs a procedure. And he said, okay, how long can I wait? This is a common discussion we're having. Like, what do you mean, how long can I wait? You can't wait. He said, no. So I'm going to go home, get the crops out, sell them in the market. That is going to take 1 month. Then I'll have the money. Then I'm going to come and get the hysterectomy done. So that was the scenario we were facing. To the same population coming in, carrying a health card, the government decided where they decided that they want to issue a digital identity card to everybody. Yeah. So you need a patient identifier. They now link that card to making sure that everyone needs to make a bank account. Then they link this identity card to a family card, which means they created a family as a unit rather than individual as a unit. So if you are four people in a family, so you get one card, so then husband, wife, and the kids are covered. And then they kind of linked it to your annual income. So government decided to keep below this particular annual income, your premium on that insurance is going to be taken care of by the government, which means one third of the country suddenly in one day had health insurance. So they started off with saying annual income less than 1.5 lakhs, which over the years they have increased to 3 lakhs. So every time they jump up the bottom line, more number of people are getting added. Now the government, we know, because we're talking to so many bureaucrats now, they're saying the government has already decided they're going to cover everybody in the country. Let's say I can afford anything. They're going to say, you still get a health card, government issued, but the premium you're going to pay. So we want to get everybody into the system linked with a digital identity. And once they did that, they put the whole thing in motion, which means everybody gets a card. They come into my system. Before they come in, they don't come into my clinic. They get their biometric done on a kiosk that I have in my hospital. Government makes sure. As soon as they do a biometric, it goes into the system. The patient is registered already. So the government knows this guy is already gone. I want to do a procedure on him. Let's say they want to get a nailing. They got to break their tibia in the village. So I have to put it in the system. He's going to go undergo nailing. Government is going to get the x-rays, pre-op, post-op, discharge date, the medicine that I gave him, and they're going to go home. And this guy is automatically in the system forever. And suddenly the data collection, which never existed, suddenly the data government now has of so many people in the country. In the next 4 to 5 years, I think the entire population of the country is going to be on sent server.
The government in this case is clever, I think. And a number of other countries could apply similar strategy. Rather than approach the problem directly, basically building more infrastructure and training facilities, something which they could not really afford and which would have taken way too long, they increased the capacity of existing systems and created a marketplace that would reward innovation. In terms of training, they revised the training rules they had instituted in colonial times and overnight tripled the number of doctors being trained. Keep in mind that they still have a massive shortage. Secondly, they created a market by providing capitated insurance to the population, gradually expanding the program as capacity increased to meet demand. To provide that insurance, they did several things. One was to create a unique patient identification number through which to assign benefits. The two are linked. You can't have one without the other. Furthermore, the ID can be issued at the site of care using biometrics, so you don't have to issue over a billion IDs all at once. Another thing that happened was that the government required banks to not charge transaction fees for online banking, meaning that everyone in India today does most transactions on their phone, even for just a few rupees. And this has many benefits to people who do not otherwise have a safe place to keep their money in some situations, like in the markets. But also means that the government, the patients, the pharmacies, and the hospitals have a way to pay for services. And then the market basically did the rest. So let's hear how this played out. It's super interesting.
So I remember I used to do an outreach camps. I would go beyond my city to villages where I would do free camps so that people can come and I can give free advice. Everybody has knee problems, right? So I'm seeing 300 patients, 300 needs knee replacements. So this is four guys sitting together screening patients. And out of the 300, we're choosing the worst of the worst who can't even walk without a knee replacement. And telling them, you need it now, you need it in a month, you need it. But then coming home, realizing of the 300 patients, 10 can afford it, 290 can't. And these are the scenario I was looking at 10 years, 8 years down the line. These same patients now have a card. And these guys are coming in, getting the card. I tell them, I can look at their walking and tell them, you need a knee replacement. And they say, do it tomorrow. They just walk in. Interestingly, my worst case are actually these patients because they were being neglected by the system for 10 years. So a lot of things are changing because of this two subtle changes that the government did, which is also causing the healthcare infrastructure, the companies and the device manufacturers, everybody to take notice. So when they started it, the cost, what the government said you would have to do, let's say a procedure, every doctor in the country was saying it's too less. You can't work like that. So there were resistance and they were back and forth. In fact, government will come in and talk to a hospital. You want to take this scheme. You want to sign up for that, let's say, card. And half the hospitals refuse. He said, I can't work my system at this low cost. But eventually, after 8 years, we are realizing more and more hospitals are picking it up because it ensures you a certain volume of work, irrespective of season, of rainfall, because that's always there. Number two, government every year or 2 years is revising that list. So the pay structure is getting better because the dialogue goes back and doctors would refuse a patient, says, because it just doesn't cover my cost. And eventually the cycle completes and somebody realizes that you need to put in more cost to that procedure. So interestingly, I was sitting with my cardiologist just yesterday. The procedure called TAVI is transaortic mitral valve replacement that is done for very sick patient that can't have open heart surgery. The procedure in India with the valve that is an FDA approved valve is 35 lakhs. It's a cost that even a good established Indian can't afford. It's a huge amount. The valve is 25 lakh rupees. Government of India put that procedure in their list just yesterday at a cost of 12 lakhs. They just half scaled, decreased the amount to half, but they put it in. And my cardiologist is saying, give it a year. The largest number of TAVI procedures being done anywhere in the world is going to be in this country because of the obvious volume. But the cost is so less. He says, but this has happened to every procedure that we've seen. Government fixes the prices. We fight it as doctors, frontline doctors, we fight it. But then every company works it around. The implant and the procedure and the medicine, the equipment starts to get cheaper so as to fit into that bracket. So as somebody who runs a system, sometimes I crib a lot saying that this is not enough revenue for the system. But from a government point of view, this is taking healthcare to a population that could never afford it. So it depends upon which side of the table you're sitting in. I sit on both sides, unfortunately. So sometimes I'm saying that it's too less, but then we work around how to do it. And then when I talk to the other guy, the other side of the table, he says, this is a fantastic thing that is being done for the country. And this is a big election winner for the present government, no doubt about it. And the election is just around the corner, 4 months down the line, and they're going to win. This is going to be third consecutive win for the government. They're making sure that this does not fail. So with that kind of backing, so this is going to be really successful. And they have all these data scientists, AI people, crunching numbers behind the back, finding out what's happening. Very interesting.
I totally agree. Very interesting. So what is the right fee for a specific service? Does that fee change with volume? And if you're guaranteed volume, can you figure out a way to deliver care for that amount on the table and still turn a profit? Clearly, that is the case here. I'm not as familiar with the cardiac procedure he described, but I was aware that in the world of joint replacement, not only did the government set a ceiling on the reimbursement for, say, a knee replacement, but they also set a fixed amount on the price of the implants that the government was willing to pay, whether these implants be low-cost versions from China or Taiwan, or the more expensive implants from the US or Europe. Some companies simply decided to pull out of India. Others were able to negotiate and in time increase the price that was being paid, but they're still far lower than what is being paid for the same devices in the United States. That is, of course, because of economies of scale. If a country decides that universal healthcare is a good idea, whether to stabilize politics or for creating economic growth through a healthy workforce, and embraces a single-payer mechanism, it has tremendous power to negotiate prices on behalf of the population. India was able to do that. Now, in the world of joint replacement, and assuming no complications, there are three buckets of costs. The largest one is the operating room. The rest is the hospitalization and the costs incurred before and after surgery, like physical therapy. So when reimbursement is low, something has to give. And I asked Vikram about his pathways and where they were able to find opportunities to save.
So, for example, a villager is coming in, no access to physiotherapy at home or nursing care. So during the time they're there, or when they are deciding on the date for the surgery, we would already identify the family members who are going to get the physio done to the patient. Now, it's not technical, but I know I can ask them to record the range of motion, the cordyceps strength, how to make him walk, how to take him to the bathroom, stuff like that. So we get those pamphlets published already, and we purposefully are training the family members. So interestingly, all vigilers most of the time are joint families, big set of people living in the same household. So it's easier. So you can train the sons and, you know, grandchildren or the wives and stuff to learn it and follow it up. Give them a lot of contact points. So every time something goes wrong, they have a soakage of dressing, bruising, deep in thrombosis, stuff like that. Train them well to WhatsApp comes in, click a lot of pictures, send it to this guy. So every evening, by the time I finish my work, my coordinators are coming in. These are the patient who are sending in these photographs, and you're making decisions based upon these pictures, which is not ideal, but looking at this picture, I'm saying this guy needs to come back to the hospital immediately. This looks like a DVT. And did we put him on oral anticoagulants? Yes, we did. But he was diabetic, he was overweight. Let's just get him in as quickly as possible. And then we send the message across. So my average length of stay, we do a lot of bilaterals versus unilaterals in this country. A lot of bilaterals, because by the time the lady or the gents decides to get it done, it's far down the line. If you tell them you're going to get 1 and 3 months rehab and then another 1 month, they're reluctant. So we do a lot of joints. So let's say 80-85% is bilateral cases. So my length of stay was 4 to 5 days 2 years ago, bilateral cases in the system 2 years ago. Then series of steps changed, which were like this. So I stopped using tourniquet. I stopped all epidurals. I stopped putting drains, and I converted my entire practice into kinematic, which all said and done, whatever it does, it has amazing recovery post-op. So my length of stay right now for a single knee, but unilateral knee is 1 day, for a bilateral is 2 days. That's an amazing thing that we have been able to achieve, because I used to go to all these conferences and talk, see Americans and Europeans talk about a daycare surgery, and I said, these guys are joking. This is, can't be possible. I'm doing exactly what they're doing, but this can't happen. This doesn't happen. But at the time, I was converting my entire practice kinematic by reading, because there's not a reference surgeon in this country who will tell you this is how the steps go of doing kinematic. I realize every time I would mention it to one of my colleagues, yeah, this is something we have heard, but we don't know. So started writing to Europeans and Vendertoli and, you know, all these people, and sending them an x-ray. My tibia tilt is like this, and I'm a little scared, and I'll get a tick or a thumbs up, and this is how it's supposed to look. This is how it's supposed to look. So that journey took me almost a year. And suddenly we have huge volumes of journals. So we centralize, we did 500 kinematics, you know, good 3-4 months, and everybody's saying that the stays decrease, and patients are achieving the range of motion so fast, not changing the joint lines, and, you know, their medial stiffness and irritation, and that stuff is really gone. And I was just so happy.
So this, of course, was music to my ears. I was one of the earliest adopters and promoters of kinematic alignment, which is a new strategy, or better, new philosophy for how to do total knee replacements. It was invented by Stephen Howe in California, and as he and I have been friends, I was able to visit with him and understand the technique. We subsequently published a book that was quite well received about 3 years ago with two colleagues, Drs. Pascal Venditoli in Canada and Charles Riviere in France. We established an international society to promote this concept across the planet and actually do the teaching that is missing, which Vikram was referencing. Today, about 50 to 70% of Europeans and Australian surgeons use this technique or one of the variations that have since arisen. And it's about 30 to 40% in the US, with the rest of the world coming around. And more or less anybody using a robot is using some version of this. Vikram, for one, clearly sees the benefits, even in a population of very advanced disease. But it's interesting to see how long it takes for new ideas, even ones that are clearly beneficial to patients, to take hold in healthcare. I think this whole process started 15 years ago with Dr. Howe. Well, I can tell you that a 2-day length of stay for bilateral total knee replacement is kind of world class. It would be hard to find a matching result in a Western system. And assuming that the results are not compromised, and by the way, no matter where we look, shortening length of stay for uncomplicated care in healthy people does not seem to impact outcomes adversely. This is probably just fine. and leveraging the family for physical therapy as well as optimizing care pathways can lead to great results, as well as increased capacity for the hospital, more throughput, and therefore adequate margins. Next, I want to get back to his personal story and that of his wife in a bit more depth.
So interestingly, when I was training as an orthopedic surgeon, I shifted to States. I gave my foreign graduate exam. Me and my wife shifted there. We matched. We gave all those interviews and we got into a residency program in New York. The process takes about a year, 2 years just to give the exams and stuff like that. And I had already done my residency here. I was working as, we call it senior residency, so 3 years post my degree. So went in States and realized that I would be starting from ground zero, because my degree doesn't count there, number one. I was looking at a lot of being a first year, second year issues that we'll have to solve. And already I was a senior guy here. To finding the cultural difference too much for me to handle, especially for my wife. And then we decided that we're not going to stay in States and come back. So at the time, everybody was saying, you are crazy going back. You guys actually got selected. You guys actually have your visas in place and you've got a job. Just have to be there for 3 to 4 years and then you'll be have a job and you'll settle in Florida, you know, wherever, and then come back. And I said, no, I just can't see myself being in the... At the time, they were right. It was a bad decision in the sense that coming back to a country that was not supporting a practice that was, we call as a high-end, you know, doing a little complicated procedure requiring a bit of equipment to undergo. And then 10 years, 20 years have passed. This is 20 years. We came back 2004. So almost 20 years have passed. I've done 20 years of my own thing. And these guys talk about what they're doing and we're talking about it. And I said, I don't regret it a day, number one, because I'm in my country. So I live with my parents and stuff. My practice is still, my patients will bring in vegetables from this garden and leave it in my office. And so make this thing in the north end, it's called as curry, but I'll get it every other day and a lot of lime and whatever locally grows. So you build up a practice where all these people know you by name. They know your families and some of them know my father and stuff like that. So I live in a neighborhood, the left side of the house, I've done knees, the right side, the back side, everywhere I've done knees. Whenever my wife would say, make sure that you do them well, because every time there's a problem, it's difficult to get to take a walk around the house. There's a community thing that I will not trade with anybody. But said, pace of change that we see now in this country is so exciting that there's a proverb that may you live in exciting times. And I think all the excitement is now concentrating in this country. Second big issue we see every day is that we in India as doctors have always been trained as pen and paper doctors. We have recorded everything on paper, which by default means we are not recording everything because there's a limit to how much can. So never filling with the thousands of forms now, but then you know how they're filled, right? So there's this thing that you need to digitalize this. But the system has levels in the sense that I can do partial health records. I can do, just choose all my nursing is on the digital mode. All my pharmacy is, or my all my labs is, or all my imaging is on PAC system or not. You choose how much level of digitalization you want to do for your hospital. But then the same thing has happened. We have this system in place now where you get your hospital certified through an organization, which we call as an NABH. It is something like Joint Commission, something like that. So NABH, when it started a small thing, and you just get certified, make sure that all your infections are being recorded, you know, stuff like that, to now huge books written on it, and you have to do all these points. NABH now diversified into, can you make a digital hospital? Everything on health record. So they bring in the code just 6 months ago. The code means that they wrote a book on it. It has about 500 points that a digital hospital needs to follow to be called a digital hospital. Now, it's not a government organization, but it's well recognized. So as soon as the code came in, we were the first hospital to say that we will adopt it. We're going to get our first inspection. And if you think you're good, you can ask them to come and inspect you. So an independent assessor from outside will come. So this month, most likely an independent assessor is going to come in and assess our preparedness to be a digital hospital. So just coming in, and we were having this meeting with my guys who's looking into this thing. That is a bit of a problem considering my access to techies is a little less because I don't work in the metros. And my people, the people who really work on a computer are not that tech savvy. So I just had to Wi-Fi my entire hospital because I wanted this laptop to be in my nurse's hand as I'm walking through the rounds. So every time I would go into a round, the first thing you, as an orthopedic surgeon, where is the rest of the day, bring in the x-ray. Now they don't want to do that. They just click set the x-ray. They're carrying a tablet with in their hand as we're walking in. So this is what we want to be finally achieve. And I'm able to look all my PACS images in my OR. I can record all of my surgeries, put it on the cloud, relay it to my auditorium, and kind of integrated all of that thing into our central database. And then we realized that sometimes the dispensation is problem. Then somebody will come back because it's taken an overdose and said because the prescription was not right. Just putting it in the system, it's digital, it's readable, and it's no substitute happening. That's a basic thing. To be able to do an ICU, which is an integrated ICU, so my intensivist is able to monitor 20 patients in one room because everything is now integrated and all the parameters of every 20 patients are on his laptop and in real time. So moment of pride because we're doing this as the first hospital, but outside the big city centers, the digitalization. So I know a lot of people can do it, but to take that initiative to be able to do it in a sort of a village setting takes some leap of faith.
So next, I asked, what are the benefits they were seeing from running a digital system in a small rural community? And also, any leadership lessons from his time running this hospital system?
When we started, we had one pharmacy in the system. Now I run five pharmacies. So five pharmacies you're running in the system, and you're buying for each one of them, and they're being sold or whatever, being used. And every 6 months, they would come in and I would have independent auditors come in, just check stock and say, so we just lost $1,000, whatever, because you never realize this, all these things are expired. Your catheters got expired and your trackers are got expired. I would say, what the hell? And I would shouting all my technicians and stuff. And how did it expire? And they were like blank, sir. They just silly answer was, or the right answer was that, so it just got pushed at the back of the shelf and we never realized. Because they had no way of knowing. The first thing, they pick it up, use it, pick it up, use it, pick it up, use it. So that was happening. I was doing so many joint replacements. So I was using how many used, 500 used. And then every year they do an audit. And so there were 15 joints got expired. I said, why? I'm doing so much. There should not be an expiry because the near expiry got pushed at the back of the cart and nobody was seeing them. Just put them, everybody on the system. So you know, and if the system's on, this has 3 months expiry, you fetch it out into the store. Get it used first instead of getting expired. This is money lost, revenue lost. I realized I can't be good administrator. I was still, how do you do it? So get people on board as administrators. I started finding talent and asking them to do it. To a point that system has grown. So we have this MBA in health tech or health management in the country. So now these universities start sending me calls. Can you do an internship? I said, why? He said, we need to send them a struggling system and see how it works. So I get people 6 months doing internship and I give them a task and solve this problem for me. And so sometimes these young people have interesting ideas. So some of them we pick up and do it. So when I started the system, so obviously we needed nurses. They'll come in and they will join my systems. They might have read, they don't know any practical thing. So I would have a system, a training system. They will go through the entire step and PP injection, stuff like that. And then one day I realized, sir, I'm leaving. My attrition rate was something like 30%, 40%. And I got my HR lady to come in and said, why? I trained them for 6 months to do any job at all. I'd handhold them. And then they leave. He said, but sir, all of them will leave. I'm like, why? He said, sir, all of them are unmarried girls. So they just finished college. To them, it's college, but they're pretty young. So they're 21, 22, 23. So the cultural thing in India is that they will do a job for 2, 3, 4 years till they get married. And if once they get married, they will move to a place where they're settling, which invariably is where their husbands are working. So I would take in a lot of nurses and then they'll come in resignation and marriage invitation. Getting married and this is my resignation. I'm like, what the hell? Should I congratulate and reward it? Why is this happening? So then we realized we can't fight this. This is a cultural thing in this country. They are going to leave. So maybe some of them will stay. Some of them will move on. How do you solve this? So first idea was tie up with lots of nursing colleges and get more. So every day we were hiring. But then we realized the best way to do this is to create an environment where the teaching becomes automatic. So we did this mentorship program. So every new nurse will get a, but we'll make sure this is the 10 things that you cannot do to a patient till she signs on it. So like BPs, you have to take 10 BPs and make sure this is the correct. And then all these colleges, the information spread that if you want to learn nursing, you need to join our hospital because your training is a little quicker because we built in nurses too. So my lag time from 6 months shortened to 2 months. So interestingly, this is a big hospital system in Delhi, 5,000 bedded, huge setup. My dad got sick 2 years ago and he had to have a triple bypass. So I was in the ICU talking to my dad. And this nurse comes in and he touches my feet. And another nurse comes and touches my feet. I said, what the hell? Why are you touching my feet? Of course, touch my father's feet, but why would he touch his feet? So he said, oh, sir, you don't remember. We are from your system. So you trained us. Then we got better. Then we interviewed here. So my father eventually was being treated by a nurse, which I trained, a default trained in my system. So very happy. But I said, why did you move from this? So young people, big city life, poor independence and stuff like that. We wanted to see the light, so we moved. That's very interesting.
One of the things I love about this story is the openness to taking on an opportunity that first presented as a challenge. So one is management, and then learning that actually he could get essentially free consulting just by letting students work in his hospital. And the same was true with nursing. It was a serious challenge, but they came up with a solution that actually works better than the original ideas. I think this is kind of great. So I also asked him a little bit about telehealth because we hadn't covered it. And so here's his response to that question.
So the idea came to me from another entrepreneurial doctor down south somewhere. I never met him. So then he runs a system, which is a 200 bed system. That's fair enough. So it's 30 outpatient clinics. He said, 30? Like, how can he run 30? You can't even take 1 day to go to a clinic. You know, 30 days will exhaust. So who is he sending to those outpatients? So when I was running my outpatients, so it would be once a week or maybe once in 10 days. And I would get exhausted, you know. And I was doing it on Sundays. And I would work 6 days and then Sunday go out. And then my wife was yelling and you're never home and stuff like that. So he said, no, he never goes. So what he does is he identifies a village. He makes a small office, 2 rooms. He deputes a nurse there and he gets that telemedicine in. Anybody who has to come, the nurse will take a basic interview, whatever test. Sometimes they get basic test and hemoglobin get done in the village. So they are in the telemedicine center. Linked to that one hospital is 30 of them. So you got purpose-built doctors sitting in that main center. The nurse will upload, get them face-to-face, talk to each other. And this doctor sitting in, so this is a 200 kilometer distance, which they don't know whether they want to do that journey or not. And he will look at the report and rightly advise them. And you have this problem, you need a surgery, you need to come in now, it's a little urgent. And if you want help, the nurse is sitting there. If you want ambulance to come in, we'll send in the ambulance. So his 200 bed system is being fed by 30 telemedicine centers run by nurses only.
This is not necessarily rocket science, as conceptually there are many versions of this type of telemedicine being practiced around the world and in even more remote locations like Alaska. However, I do think it is important to take stock of the fact that as one doctor with a very basic digital infrastructure and a nurse in each of these clinics with very basic training that then leveraged staff that was already present at a fairly distant hospital to set up services that could reach 20 villages. The government is not directly involved. No insurers are involved. There are no venture capitalists in the picture. It's just one entrepreneurial physician, 30 nurses, a few laptops, and a connection to physicians at a central facility. I think it's pretty impressive. I'll have to follow up with Vikram to see if he has followed suit. Okay, so we've come to the end of this conversation, and I hope what you take away from it is that even hard things are possible. Sometimes challenges hide major opportunities and that great ideas come from being open to them. Vikram not only traveled for education and ideas, but he was also open to learn from others, whether they be business school students from the big city or other medical entrepreneurs, as we just heard. Another take-home message, perhaps, is that if home is where the heart is, maybe home is where one should be. After all, it was Vikram's deep knowledge of local culture and its needs that led to his success as an entrepreneur. And many thanks to Vikram for sitting with me for nearly 2 hours in the hotel. The conversation made us hungry and we feasted on a never-ending dinner of amazing Indian food. It was also one of the conversations that, along with so many others I heard as we traveled around the world meeting digital health innovators, convinced me that nearly everything is possible. It takes the right mindset and perhaps circumstances, but it can be done, whatever it is. I look forward to our next conversation, wherever it takes us around the world. Hey there, this is Stefano again, and I'm excited to share this new podcast. I traveled the world on my sabbatical, and I was meeting healthcare innovators with incredible stories, and I just want to share them. So let's connect. I want to hear your thoughts. DM me on LinkedIn, and I'll reply to every message. And if you like these conversations as much as I did, share the podcast. Give it a like. Your support will help spread these inspiring stories to even more people. Thank you.